Hello and welcome to the College of Optometrists podcast. I'm Martin Cordiner, Head of Research at the College.
And I'm Daniel Hardiman-McCartney, Clinical Advisor at the College.
So as the two people apparently cogent enough to talk into a mic, or probably just the two free to do so right now, we have the pleasure of bringing you my interview with Professor Pete Coffey, Professor of Cellular Therapy and Visual Sciences at the Institute of Ophthalmology, University College London, and Director of the London Project to Cure Blindness. Ophthalmology is also quite a hard word to say, but I'm a lot better at that now. That's what working at the College does to you. I spent a bit of time speaking to Professor Pete about his project to cure blindness as he talked through stem cells, transplantations, and other mad scientist sounding stuff that's basically about giving people their sight back and doing it all on his self-imposed tight timescale.
Well, Martin, in practice, not a week goes past without a patient coming in clutching a news article about a treatment or a discovery. And you know, more often than not, it's the science misreported or it may be decades away. So I'm really looking forward to hearing Professor Pete really talk about taking the science from the bench to the bedside. And also, you know, I find it a challenge separating the false claims from the studies that really matter. So hearing about what this might mean for patients in practice now and in the near future, and really just enabling, you know, optometrist in practice being able to update patients about what they need to know and what's going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, also researchers, you know, for decades now have been going on about stem cells as being the most promising advance in medicine since antibiotics.
Yeah.
But, you know, what does that mean in practice? You know, is it really going to work?
So as a patient turned up to you with a clipping saying stem cells, this, that and the other?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a regular thing. And sometimes it is just completely crazy articles that are misreported. But clutching onto that hope that they will make a difference.
There must be someone who's turned up with a bit from The Onion or something. You know, the spoof website says eyes can be replaced by torches or something. I'm sure that's happened.
Eyes being replaced does happen.
Yes. In other news, eyes can now be replaced by torches. No, that's not true. So we have to apologise about losing some of the start of this interview due to the vagaries of technology, which is really annoying because Pete shared with me the meaning of life, a substantial series of winning lottery numbers before we got properly started on the old curing blindness stuff. But as several colleagues could attest to, I don't have a good enough memory to remember it all, so that, you know, that's all gone now. Well, this reminds me of other things I've lost that were important to me. I once had a Foo Fighters t-shirt. Lost forever. And you know how when you lose something in your own house, you're like, okay, I could turn my house upside down now to go looking for this thing, or I could just accept it's probably lost. Yourself? Important things lost?
My Atari joystick from
first
game system.
That is... The thing is, you were ready to tell me that. I could feel it bubbling up. You were like, this has lived with me for a long time. So it just disappeared?
Just disappeared.
Do you have siblings?
Three.
So one of... I'm just going to put it out there. One of them, maybe?
Absolutely.
Okay, I think we'd possibly better leave it there before we end up with something slanderous. So I began by asking Pete how he got started with his groundbreaking work. Where were you in previously? Is there a moment you can remember that you took particular interest in it?
I can definitely remember it was a Friday night.
That's
it was
always
down
good.
The Turf Tavern.
Wow.
In Oxford, and there was a visiting professor from Pittsburgh, a guy called Ray Lund. And he had been doing some transplantation studies, and the two of us then considered, well, could we really target a system that something's really known about, as in the brain, and actually the eye is part of the brain, and there was huge amounts of information in terms of obviously what does the eye do, and it perceives the world, as opposed to other parts of the brain, which we know are involved in things like Parkinson's disease and motor, but we don't actually know what that bit of the brain. The eye was where we decided to do it. So a year after that Friday night at the Turf, I literally changed direction in my research.
Wow. Of such specific moments can careers be born. Amazing. So you started the London Project to Cure Blindness with Professor Lyndon de Cruz of Moorfields.
So from the outset, the whole idea of the London Project to Cure Blindness was not only to look at basic science. So can we actually consider the eye as a good place? Can we look at possible cells which we could use? But it was to really accelerate what we knew was happening in the lab into a clinical treatment. So could we actually get from the bench to the bedside, as it's often called, quickly and as safely, and within a period of 5 years is what we initially promised. As I said in the talk, actually, we failed at that. It took us 8 years. And there was lots of reasons for that,
of course,
including my own naivety. And also, no one had done it before. Unbelievably, no one had actually used a cell therapy in Europe for this type of work, or any type of work in terms of regenerative medicine for a CNS system. And even now, as we speak, it's still the first one to have actually gone through that clinical trial.
So it's interesting that probably, you know, some science starts with, let's see what we can find out, but you were starting right from the outset to say, this is the aim we want to achieve, and even if we don't quite know how to do it yet, this is where we're trying to get to.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things we were determined to do, because we gave ourselves such a short time period, I mean, typically it can take 10, 20 years to not even a cell therapy, any therapy into a clinical trial. So what we, from the outset, decided was to bring everything together that we would need to do that. So in that endeavour, we needed engineers, we need manufacturers, we need clinicians, bit of engineering, bit of science, bit of research, bit of clinic. And that's why it takes 20 years.
Mm.
So we were trying to smash that way of doing it and bring it into this everything at once. But in doing everything at once, you need a lot of money,
yeah,
and a lot of people. And we were fortunate in that we are a philanthropist, an American philanthropist from the East Coast, decided he was going to support us in doing that. So we could bring everyone together.
So was the aim to do it in a shorter time frame just because you thought, well, this is pressing, this is urgent, or you just thought, well, this, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be done that way, maybe we can try something new?
The main reason for doing it was just it was a huge unmet clinical need. And the longer it took, the more people. I mean, you know,
sure,
as I said, there's something like 700,000 patients in the UK suffer from it. It's often called Alzheimer's of the eye because we have the numbers suffering from that disease as people are predicting for Alzheimer's in about, you know, 2030. We have those numbers now. It's huge. So we wanted to do it as quickly as possible. You know, if we could have done it even sooner than 5 years, we would have said that. But I thought 5 years was going to be tough, and it was.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the whole goal was to get it into a clinic as soon and as safely as possible.
So your project is aiming to use stem cells to treat AMD. I think most of us will have heard of the phrase stem cells used on the news in papers, sort of bandied around a bit, but may not know specifically what they are, why they're useful. And in your talk, you mentioned the cornea is a stem cell. So can you explain basically what they are and how they
sure.
work?
Sure. So a stem cell, as it suggests, is the starting cell from which the rest of our bodies are made from. And there are stem cells in our bodies now. So the blood system comes from a stem cell, comes from the hematopoietic stem cell lineage. So there are mature stem cells. But the issue around producing a therapeutic is, can we actually get a cell type which is usable as a therapy? And typically that comes from what's called an early stem cell, from a source which we literally were born from. And they come from, at the moment, probably two potential sources. One is embryonic, and the second is what is called the induced pluripotent. So this is a way of turning back time in your own cells to get to that beginning cell again. So those stem cells, you know, make two choices, two very simple choices. Either they make more of themselves, which is more stem cells, which aren't of any use, really. They're not usable as a therapeutic. People have suggested all you have to do is put stem cells into a person and they will work out what has to be done. That doesn't happen. And
right.
In fact, nasty things can happen
right.
if you do that. So the idea is to actually, the second thing a stem cell will do is turn into a cell. It'll turn into an eye or a heart or a lung. And if we know how that pathway occurs, how it manages that, we can actually come up with a process to make those cells into what we want. And in our case, we've wanted eye cells. And we have many, many ways now of making eye cells of different types as well. So the light-sensitive cells, the support cells, which is what's called the RPE, and the blood cells, etc.
So how are skin cells transformed into retinal cells? This might be a huge question that's very hard to
articulate. So from the work which started in the 50s, in terms of what people remember as cloning, so Dolly the sheep.
Mm.
So our cells, our adult cells, have that code, that pathway, how they developed into what they are. It still remains in the cell. It's still in there. And it's within our genetic code. And from that early work in the late 50s, the under 50s up until now, and a particular group in Japan, Shinya Yamanaka's group, realised that if you just turn a couple of genetic switches on, so you just switch those genes on, and lo and behold, that programme of development starts again and turns the cell, which was an adult cell, so it was mature, it knew what it wanted to be, turns it back to that beginning cell, what we came from.
And do you think it's there's a sort of evolutionary reason why cells would continue to be able to do that throughout our lifetimes, or it's just in sort of inherent way in which cells work and the body works?
It's a good question. I think an answer, I'm not suggesting it's the only answer,
sure,
is our bodies clearly do have cells in them which can regenerate. So, for example, our liver can regenerate a certain amount. As I said, the blood system is a stem cell, so it's a starting cell. So there are some components within our bodies in which you want that to happen. And as such, a good thing would be to make sure that program that allows that is still accessible. So there are good reasons for that to be there.
Mm-hmm. So how are the stem cells, once made, transplanted into the retina itself? What are the challenges of doing that?
So the major challenge is you have to put the cells back from where they've died. And in the particular disease which we have attempted to try and use these cells and a therapy using cells, the bit of the eye that dies is the support cells right at the back of the eye. So if you look at someone's eye, you get a black pupil. The black pupil is a reflection of those cells. It's the support cells, which are black, right at the back of the eye. So we have to surgically implant those cells into the back of the eye. So it is a surgery which has to be done. And it's a surgery which can take from 45 minutes to an hour.
It's astonishingly quick.
It's not as quick as a cataract.
Right,
we'd love
yeah.
if it was a cataract, yeah. which is 10 minutes.
The ultimate aim.
But but we actually modelled it on cataracts. So the whole idea was to make it, again, as safe but as quickly as possible, such that it could really be considered a therapeutic within the NHS.
So it's aiming to replace the retinal pigment epithelium. And is that because that layer is particularly conducive to being replaced or particularly good for this purpose?
That's the main cell which is affected initially in the disease, age-related macular degeneration. It is by far the best cell to try and replace. It's not a neural cell. It doesn't have to connect into it. So it's a cell that, you know, almost exists on its own, and it's just a single layer of cells, which means it's like a carpet. So for all intents and purposes, in terms of any type of a cell therapy, it's got to be one of the easiest ones to attempt. So it's not neural. You don't have to get it to connect into a neural network or anything. So for us, it was definitely the one we wanted to go for first because it was easier.
Sounds good. So you're also attempting to create photoreceptors from stem cells that can then also be implanted. Why is that different? Why are there different challenges involved in doing that?
So there's two major challenges there. The first being The photoreceptor is probably one of the most specialized cells in the whole of our bodies. So just getting it out of a stem cell hasn't been easy. And that process of understanding how a stem cell turns into an eye cell has taken quite a while to understand. And, you know, we have, you know, basically two different types of light sensitive cells in the back of the eye. One which is easier to get than the other. So, and unfortunately, the easier one to get is involved in night vision, whereas right. the one we really want is the one that's involved in, you know, reading and driving, which is what's called the cone. Mm. And that's been a lot more difficult to get. And then the second major problem, as I said, and why we went for RPE first of all, is those photoreceptors have to reconnect into a neural network. And that neural network itself is damaged. Mm. So there's a lot of things which we're trying to work out of how to actually get those cells to behave the way we want to, which again is not fully understood.
Mm-hmm. Have you set yourself a time target for that as well?
We have. We are on course for that.
Oh, brilliant.
So maybe we have actually learnt from our previous work. But yeah, we're on course for that, which is it's a 3-year project at the moment.
Amazing. So does the treatment of wet versus dry AMD differ when it comes to these issues, the transplanting of stem cells and what you're trying to do?
It doesn't differ as long as you're actually going in at a similar time in the course of the disease.
Right.
So the reason we chose wet was we're going in at an early stage of the disease, so that there's only one thing affected, which is that support cell, the RPE. So as long as that's the only cell type affected, whether it be wet or dry, they're both the same. We can replace it. But what has happened on a number of trials which have attempted the dry transplantation first is they've gone into very late stage, or what we would call end stage disease. When the patient is blind. The patient is blind because the support layer is not, as in the RPE, is not the only cells that have died. Mm. So you've also got the light sensitive cells have died, so the cones which I mentioned. And also there's a big blood supply at the back of the eye called the choroid, and that's diseased and started to die. Mm. So just put one layer of cells, which is the RPE, isn't going to regenerate the other two.
Yeah.
So you may actually stop, isn't going to regenerate the other two.
Yeah.
So you may actually stop the progression of the disease, but you're not going to restore vision.
So the timing is everything, really.
Timing is everything as ever.
Indeed. So in 2015, you successfully implanted stem cell-derived retinal pigment epithelium into two patients with subretinal bleeds. What were the results? What does that mean for the possibility of treatments becoming available more widely?
So they were two very bad cases. You've always got to thank your clinical colleagues for giving you good cases. They were very bad cases, and both of them had what were uncontrollable bleeds and were definitely in the process of going blind. And literally 6 months after the operation, both patients were not only seeing again, as in able to read letters, they were able to read. And in one case, there was one patient who, at the time of the, or prior to the surgery, couldn't even see the book. And now he's actually reading about 50 words a minute. Both those patients have retained good visual outcome for the last 3 years. So their vision has been restored to a level which we didn't expect.
So it's so comprehensive that it can have such a big effect on visual function. That's quite amazing.
We expected to see some visual recovery.
Yeah.
But I think I can honestly say that we were surprised how good the visual restoration or the visual recovery was. It was very good in both patients.
And is that something that you've been able to learn from in terms of what you do next and the further developments? I mean, it obviously shows this is very much worth pursuing. This is something that's going to have a huge effect on people's lives. But does it also improve your ability to actually perfect these procedures?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we've learned a lot over the last 3 years from those two patients. There are things which we definitely will change and improve. Not just the surgery itself. We even think we might be able to change some of the surgical tools, which would help the procedure. But equally, you know, the way in which we made the RPE, that was locked down back in 2009. You know, that's 10 years ago.
Mm.
We have major improvements in how we can make those cells better.
So do you think it could produce even more improvement, even more ability for people to regain the visual function? That's the
potentially,
hope.
Potentially.
Wow.
Yeah.
So would most patients be suitable for this treatment? Or would I take it that the stage of the disease obviously has a bearing on this? Taking that into account is one thing. Are there other things that mean that some patients are more suitable or less suitable?
Yeah, so if you actually take the dry patients, then clearly if you have had the disease encroach, you know, your vision and your central vision is gone, then just putting the RPE back would not help those patients. It may slow the progression, but it's not going to improve, you know, the visual outcome as such.
Mm.
Therefore, it is crucial at what time we go into the patients. At the moment, with the patients with the bad bleeds that are uncontrollable, the window is 6 weeks. With the dry patients, we would expect potentially to look at a drop-off in their vision suddenly occurring maybe after 6:36.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else about particular patients that would make them more or less? Or is the exciting thing that, you know, this taken into account, this could work for almost anybody?
Yeah, I think at the moment we don't know whether there might be a select group that benefit more than others.
Right.
And clearly there's a lot of differences between patients depending on, even within the dry, there are, you know, many flavours of dry.
Mm.
Within the wet, there's many flavours of wet. So it may be the case that there are certain populations which would benefit more or less. We don't know yet. I mean, that would obviously come once larger trials occur.
So how exciting is it to make such an impact on someone's sight?
It's quite amazing. I wish it could be more. You know, we were slowed down for certain reasons, but by far it's the pinnacle of my career, that's for sure.
Amazing.
And it's rare for someone of any ilk to literally, you know, get a therapeutic into a patient group and, you know, see that happen. So no, for me it's been fantastic.
So what next for the project?
So the next thing is, can we actually build the other layers? So like I said, you know, dependent on how long the disease has been, you know, will depend on a number of layers being affected. So the blood supply, the light sensitive cells, and the support cells. So we're trying to, believe it or not, we're trying to rebuild the whole macula. So that's London Project 2.
Yeah.
And another component to the side of that is to ensure that what we've done with the current therapeutic approach, so just the single patch, the RPEs, try and get that into general clinical use as quickly as possible.
Is it possible to get that into more clinical use around the country? Is that something that's going to be feasible?
Yes. So, you know, we even with just one place manufacturing, would be able to service the UK. So in terms of getting it from where the patches are made to a clinic within the UK, that's very, very doable.
Fantastic. So How do you think conferences like Optometry Tomorrow help to translate research into clinical practice?
I don't think it translates. I think the importance of these meetings is to make what is obviously a group which are seeing a population and testing their vision and allowing them to see what we're trying to do in terms of those diseases which they themselves will see. AMD is prevalent, and optometrists will see it. They'll see the early signs as well. You see these deposits in the back of the eye, drusen. The first people to see those is probably going to be the optometrist. So to see and understand what we're trying to develop, and even monitoring some of the patients which we will be treating with these new treatments, is going to be essential in terms of the optometry profession. So yeah, it's important to actually be able to present that work so they understand what we're trying to do. So actually, go back even, in terms of the translation, the optometrists are going to be essential in terms of assessing whether these things work or not.
Great. Professor Pete Coffey, thanks very much for your time today.
Pleasure. Thanks very much.
So thanks to Pete Coffey, for coming in to talk to us. He is a busy man, so that was really appreciated. And also for his super helpful ways of explaining this cutting edge science behind replacing bits of the retina. For more on Pete and his work, head to www.thelondonproject.org or watch, the news, because it's been on there and it probably will be again.
On our next podcast, we'll be speaking with Patrick Gunn on all things glaucoma related. And you can hear much more from speakers like these at Optometry Tomorrow 2020.
Have you got your ticket yet, Daniel? It's a trick question. You have to go anyway. Until next time, goodbye.